Ted, I promise we'll get to the book in a second, but in the here and now, what is happening in the Democratic Party? Is it an identity crisis? Is it a hard left versus regular left schism?
I don't think there is a schism like that. I think what's happening is people are very frustrated right now, and they want someone who starts to talk to them about the issues of their lives. The issue is they can't afford anything. There's no opportunity. Yeah, everything's crushing down on them. They've got a government that's dysfunctional. And there are very powerful voices out there that are talking about new ideas and new plans to, you know, make things work better again. I don't think the Democratic Party is nearly as divided as people think it is. I think, you know, and what's happening in Wisconsin right now, you know, is an example of that. You got someone who ran a campaign, the pollsters, by the way, primary polling is almost impossible, okay,
yes,
when it comes
yes.
to horse race. So, you know, people are misled by that. But, you know, people say, oh, what happened? How can this, and, you know,
the Francesca Hong had a lead,
right.
thought to be the front runner, loses narrowly.
Yes.
Then they have a unity breakfast
that's right.
this morning.
Yeah.
Where everyone's on board.
Yeah, and I'm not one of the Democrats. I am a Democrat, too. I'm not a Democratic Socialist. I'm a Democrat. And I'm one of the Democrats who doesn't want the Democratic Socialist to go out and run in November as a third party, because we're going to lose every election if that happens.
Right.
So I welcome them to be part of the Democratic Party. And if they participate and win, I think we should support them.
So I want to get your sense, because you write in the book about the three most important things for a successful candidate: authenticity, emotion, storytelling. And I will give you three names from this cycle, and I want you to evaluate what happened to them. Abdul El-Sayed in Michigan, Graham Plattner in Maine, Francesca Hong in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Okay? El-Sayed is the one who's going to go on, who
right.
won his primary.
Right.
Graham Plattner had Bernie's endorsement, a lot of stuff behind him, then it collapsed. Francesca Hong never got Bernie's endorsement or AOC's.
Yeah. Interesting.
And lost narrowly. Right. Run me through those three.
Well, I think they all had a tremendous element of authenticity. You know, they were different than the typical politicians. They presented themselves as themselves. They talked about issues that connected with the people. I think with El-Sayed, you've got a doctor who cares about healthcare. Okay, and that's about as authentic as it gets.
And who ran in 2018 and is eventually yeah. saying the same things now he said in 2018.
That's right.
So there's a through line.
There is. And then, listen, that was true with Bernie and for over 40 or 50 years, not just, you know, a few years. So I think you had authentic candidates. I think they had interesting stories. I think there was emotional impact. But in the end, you know, voters are going to make decisions about candidates, not just about what they're saying, but who they are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think in two of those three instances, you know, they you know, in Plattner, they started to hear some really bad things about his
yeah.
past, you know, with
which were discoverable, but tolerated
right.
for a while.
Yeah, because
erroneously,
I think so, because, you know, as the evidence mounted, you know, in terms of these allegations against him, it became clear to people that this is something that, you know, probably is more likely to be true than not true.
So there is an establishment versus non-establishment dynamic going on.
Sure,
and that's
there is.
One of your gripes
oh,
in your book.
Absolutely.
Okay.
I'm so not saying the establishment doesn't exist.
Right. Yeah. So talk to me about yeah. that and what that is, what that thing is actually about. The Democratic establishment.
Sure.
What does that mean to you? Why does it send the party in erroneous ways?
Right.
And why does it need to be toppled?
Well, listen, I used 2016 as a case study of what happened. And that establishment then really controlled the party and the way it picked our nominee for president. And it imposed a set of rules that made it almost impossible for someone who wasn't part of the establishment to be the
who
nominee.
Wasn't Hillary Clinton.
That's right. Basically, they had decided Hillary Clinton was going to be the nominee before anyone voted. And not only did they have a set of rules that favored her enormously, they also did things like, for example, make the Democratic National Committee you know, a partner of one of the campaigns. I mean, and you know, and this stuff isn't just allegations. Later, when WikiLeaks released all the emails. I mean, if this were a court of law,
the evidentiary trail was obvious.
The jury would be out for about 15 minutes. Okay, I mean, it was just it was all there in black and white.
Is that establishment encrusted, barnacled, still there now?
Absolutely. You know, there are leaders who have been there for a long time. There are people in power. There's and a big part of the establishment is the money. Okay, the money that flows through politics.
Whose money?
Well, a lot of it is it's a variety. Sometimes it's fundraisers who raise a lot of money individually. Nowadays, though,
interest groups, teachers' unions.
Sure. In the Democratic Party, we have groups that are important. The big money, though, right now is moving towards the Republicans because and this is my own, and I write about this in the book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I believe what happened after 2008 is the Republicans were terrified. They saw this guy, a young African American man,
Barack Obama,
who not only outraised John McCain. campaign in the traditional forms of people going to, you know, events,
fundraising,
but he outraised them online in massive amounts. So they had to do something. And I think what they decided to do is they decided to change the rules. They decided to make it so that people in this country can give unlimited amounts of money anonymously to campaigns. I mean, I've worked on 29 campaigns outside the United States. If people did this in, you know, Western Europe, they'd go to jail. Okay, people can't even conceive that we have a system of campaign funding that allows people to anonymously donate tens of millions, or in the case of like Elon Musk and others, hundreds of millions of dollars individually to a campaign and have no accountability for it.
Mm-hmm. And that's part of what a Democratic establishment still tries to attach itself to,
well,
and because it can, retains power that you think should be reassessed
at minimum. I do. It's because the problem is the money, okay? And this was Bernie's campaign message in 2016, and he had been saying it for a long time. I think we figured out how to say it concisely, you know, and deliver it concisely in advertising, things like that, that America has a rigged economy that is held in place by a corrupt system of campaign finance. That is so true today, okay, 10 years later. And that was the problem then. And until we as a party, the Democratic Party, address that problem and deal with it, we're going to continue to have a rigged economy. We must change it. We must find a way to change campaign financing. I think there are steps in the middle. I mean, for example, Mayor Mamdani, you know, who won election. And people focus on, well, he's so great online, and he's those, you know, it was a new kind of campaigning, and the television doesn't count. In fact, New York has an enormously generous campaign system of, a campaign finance system of matching funds. I think it's an 8-to-1 match. You raise a buck, you get eight. You know, and that provided not a ceiling, because the super PACs had the ceilings. They were coming in
but
with tens of millions of dollars. There was a floor
it's
for
a
him to communicate.
Floor.
That's right. And I think if we started to do that in places, to allow people to go in to demonstrate that they can raise money. I mean, you have to raise a lot of money in New York to become eligible for the funding. But if you do that, you can run enough you can get enough money to fight back against the super PACs. And I can tell you, as someone who makes television ads for a living in campaigns, you can spend as much money as is imaginable raising, but there is no ceiling for how much you can raise, but there is a floor. And the floor is that you get enough communication to get through to people so they understand who you are and what your message is. And if we can find a system to let that happen, as they did in New York City, other candidates can break through. But we're not going to fix the big problem in American politics until we get rid of dark money, massive amounts of money, until people are accountable. We need the kind of campaign finance reform that we saw after Watergate.
So you write in the book that if Bernie had been the nominee in 2016, Bernie beats Donald Trump.
Yeah, you know, Major, I have no doubt about that, okay, in my mind. But, you know, of course.
And that's not the self-serving Tad Devine who helped run the campaign. Absolutely, objectively believe it and could make a persuasive slide deck.
I could. Okay. Well, first of all,
let's
look at the numbers. Okay. All the polling said that he always did better against Trump than Hillary.
Tony Fabrizio said it.
Tony Fabrizio, who's Trump's pollster, goes to Harvard. You know, they had this. I've been to a few of these after the election, unfortunately, on the losing side.
Right.
And, you know, and everybody.
It's a big postmortem.
Yeah, a big postmortem. And he was asked, he said, well, if it had been Sanders, what would have happened? He said, Sanders would have won. Okay. And this is Trump's pollster publicly saying. And if anybody knows Tony, he's the guy who just says what he says. Okay.
Right.
You know, and I would say this is, to me, beyond Trump's pollster saying it, the most persuasive piece of evidence is this. When you had open primaries, we just had one yesterday in Wisconsin, where independents can make a decision, should I vote in the Democratic primary or the Republican primary? Because both primaries of two parties are held on the same day. And the outcome is consistently that one candidate, in this case, 2016, Bernie Sanders, beginning in New Hampshire, he got, you know, it was an open primary in New Hampshire, he got 150,000 votes. The record had been John McCain in 2000, you know, against George W. Bush. And I thought that record would never be broken. When Bernie got 150,000 votes there, when he won Michigan, which had open primary, we were 25 points behind 5 weeks out, and we won Michigan. When he won Wisconsin by double digits, when he won those events where people participated in mass primaries, but independents could go one way or the other, that was the most important and significant clue that he was the one who would be strongest in the general election.
So, Tad, I'm sure you've thought about this. Let's just do a thought experiment. Paint me a picture of America in 2017 with Bernie Sanders inaugurated, not Donald Trump.
Well, it would be a very different place than it is today. I mean, I wish we should go back to Gore, though, okay? That's the one I really wanted to get straight.
We'll get there in a second.
What a world it would be. But listen, I think we'd be a very different place. What Bernie would have done is, you know, and not that there wouldn't have been battles about it, even within the Democratic Party, but he would have focused on an economic agenda for the nation. He would have looked very hard at how we can improve the wages of people, how they could afford things like housing, how they could afford health care. He would have pushed very hard to make health care available to everyone in the country, Medicare for all. I don't know if everything would have been accomplished or finished, but he certainly would have taken us in a completely different direction. Climate change, which is the existential threat to humanity. We would have made enormous progress on that front, and you know, if he had had two terms as president, or even just one. So, you know, that's it would be a different place, an entirely different place. And I think just the last part is, he would have taken on the challenge of campaign finance, because he understood then and understands today, that is the problem. Until we change that, we cannot really get this country moving in the right direction.
It is often said, Tad, that the Republican Party is now Donald Trump's party. Mm. Is the Democratic Party 30%, 45%, 65%, 85% Bernie Sanders' party?
Well, I think a high percentage, I wouldn't say it's a majority of Democratic voters. You know, if we say, who is the Democratic Party? Well, to me, the Democratic Party are people who participate in Democratic Party events, begin primaries, mm-hmm. and then go out and vote for Democrats in general elections. To me, that's the party. It's the people who are the party, not the leaders of the party. Amongst that group of people, how is he represented? I think he probably has more following than anyone else in right. the Democratic Party. I can't think of anyone who would have a stronger following than him.
His endorsement creates press attention. Yeah. His endorsement creates money. His endorsement creates visibility unlike almost anyone else in the
That's
party.
Right. I mean, President Obama is still enormously popular, but he's not as engaged in politics. You know, Bernie's still in elective office, and he spends all of his time and tremendous energy, you know, going out and getting people involved as well.
Mm-hmm. So this book is called How the Democrats Screwed Bernie.
Right.
And don't be offended. I read this book. I read it all. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of widget stuff about how politics works.
Sure.
I didn't get a lot of information on the screw part of it. So help my audience understand what, because let me put a premise on the table. If there are rules and the rules exist mm-hmm. and one candidate wins and one candidate loses and both candidates follow the rules, I don't think you're getting screwed.
Right.
One person worked the rules better than the other.
Sure.
But you're saying there's something different beyond the rules that went on, particularly in 2016.
There is.
Now, Enumerate. First,
I would say that the rules did screw him. And by the way, I went to Vermont, and I talked about this in the book with right. he and Jane, and spent a weekend with them. And I said, listen, Bertie, you can't win under the system. I understand it very well. I spent a whole decade of the 80s working it, and I explained it to him. You know, but beyond the system that was in place that you know, you have to accept when you're going to run within it, some things happened in 2016 that should never happen again. For example, the Democratic National Committee is supposed to be an independent body that administers the nominating process. In 2016, it was a wholly owned subsidiary of the Clinton campaign. Okay, the Clinton campaign ran it. You know, the debates, for example, we had four debates right. in 2016. They had about 20, you know, when Obama ran. And, you know, where did that come from? Well, it came from a memo that a friend of mine, you know, who was working for the Clinton campaign, sent over to them and saying, we're going to have four debates. Here's when they should be. You know, one of them was on the Saturday night before Christmas. Okay. I mean, it was, really, you know, the opposite of what the Republicans were doing. They were having a number of debates. They were showcasing them, putting them in prime time, getting people to watch them. The Democrats had a limited number of debates because they didn't want to expose Hillary to, you know, to some kind of opportunity to make a mistake. I mean, mm-hmm. that should never happen. There were, you know, and beyond that, and I write about this in some detail in the book. You know, as we really started moving, okay, basically what happened was he announced in April, before the deadline he had imposed, and said he was going to run. And then we kind of launched the campaign a month later, and he began to travel around the country, attracting crowds. People mm-hmm. would come 10,000, 10,000, 15,000, the West Coast, 25,000, all down the coast. Something was happening. And then the Clinton campaign understood, because they did the one thing that campaigns do when they're in trouble. They went on television and started advertising.
Right.
They started a media campaign in Iowa and New Hampshire in August. We really weren't ready to get in. You know, I showed the ads to Bernie and Jeff Weaver. I walked over. He said, what do you think? I said, well, you know, we can't play this game. We can't win that game. So we waited until November 3 months later before we went on TV. But at that point, once we went on TV in Iowa, New Hampshire, we started moving there too. I mean, not that he hadn't moved on his own, he had, but we not only moved his favorable, we not only moved to, you know, things about him, his attributes, we began to move the horse race, and it closed and it closed. And that's when the party went into action. And the way they went into action was not, they had already rigged the debate schedule. They already had a set of rules that made it almost impossible for him to win. But when they took away our voter files, okay, when they made a decision, you know, over something, you know, that a few young people on the campaign for a few hours saw the Clinton voter files, and they said we had, you know, broken into their campaign.
Right. It was a dispute about this trespassing. Was it intentional? Right. Was it malevolent? Was it somehow criminal or the implication thereof? Right. You describe it in the book as largely cursory and more innocent than not.
Absolutely.
The Clintons described it as something approaching a high crime, possibly a misdemeanor, and then you lost access.
Right.
So, from your writing in the book, that was a pretext to deprive you of something that was vital.
It was, because the voter files for us were not only the primary organizational tool of the ground campaign in Iowa and New Hampshire, it was the way we raised money. Okay, because we weren't having big fundraisers with George Clooney, okay? Right. We were, you know, sending out emails and trying to raise money through the grassroots. And when they took away that tool, you know, the intent in my mind was very clear. They were going to do everything to stop us, okay? They took away the primary tool for us to organize the campaigns, and they did it on specious grounds, in my view. And more importantly than that, I'll tell you, I used to practice law not far from here, just down the street. I'm the only guy who got a job out of the Mondale campaign, because I got hired at Winston & Strawn, where Walter Mondale was a senior partner, and I used to practice law. And what they really did was they broke the contract. We had paid $250,000 to get those voter files for the first four states. And the contract said explicitly that either side would give the other side 10 days written notice before any action was taken. They didn't abide by that contract. Yeah. They just went in, they shut us down because they were afraid we were going to win. And we almost did in Iowa. I think maybe we did, but we didn't get it counted.
Three-tenths of 1%.
And we certainly won in New Hampshire. There can be no denying that.
Blowout.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. You also write in the book that when Donald Trump entered in the summer of 2015, there was a lot of Bernie in his rhetoric. Mm. And to read that part of the book, I'm reminded, because I covered that campaign, it was, if you accept that premise, it's Bernie plus immigration.
Right. Well, immigration and a lot more stuff, okay?
Yeah.
Unfortunately,
yeah.
Which had a very dark side. You know, racism, xenophobia. I mean, you know, that's
But the
Trump
remarks
offered.
That got attention when he came down the escalator were about immigration.
Yeah.
But you said there were a lot of other things that were very Bernie-esque.
Yeah. Well, he talked about Social Security and how it is important to protect it. He talked about don't touching Medicare and Medicaid, and the Republicans need to get away from that. I mean, if you say,
and the foul money in the system.
Absolutely. And, you know, the swamp, you know, and called the
and
swamp
industrialization down. And jobs for
totally.
American workers.
Trade policy.
Yeah.
You know, he had a litany of issues where he was talking about the stuff that Bernie had been talking about for a long time. And in some cases, with the same language that Bernie was using. You know, and I have no doubt that they were watching what happened with Bernie in the summer of 2015, the people he was attracting, how his message was connecting with people. And Trump, being completely transactional, just decided he was going to take that part. But he added to it another wing to his plane, okay, which was the worst side of politics. And that's the world we live in today.
Mm-hmm. Shane Goldmacher works at the New York Times. I'm sure you know him. I used to work with him at National Journal. He recently wrote a story about the autopsy that was produced.
Right, the DNC autopsy.
And a missing chapter from that. And that missing chapter was about whether it was a good idea for Joe Biden to run at all for re-election. And then there's a long dispute about whether or not it was or was not included. Right. That seems to me, from your vantage point, having read the book, a kind of crystallization of this problem.
Right.
The party doesn't want to admit what's gone wrong.
Right.
Even when it tries to admit what went wrong, it can't bring it, it can't stomach the truth.
Right.
That's part of this problem, is it not?
I think it is. I mean, listen, I think to anybody who saw the debate between Biden and Trump knew that Biden shouldn't have run for president. Okay, period.
Hello.
End of story. I don't think there's anyone who can doubt that. And people say, oh, he's having a bad night or everything. Listen, I have tremendous respect for President Biden and what he did in 2020 to win that race. And I was very proud to help out, I mean, making ads for the Democratic National Committee, ironically enough, you know, in support of his candidacy. And what he did as a president, I think, is historic. But for him to run was a mistake, and the party really needed to have a contest about who would be our nominee, and when we didn't have it, they paid an awful price.
back to the autopsy, this thing that was missing. One of the things it raised was most senior Democratic strategists in 2024 were financially secure and thus removed from the challenges facing many Americans. It is therefore possible, it wrote, the people in the room at the highest levels of 2024 decision-making misunderstood the mood and practicalities facing everyday America.
Yeah,
Do you think there is a consultantocracy in the Democratic establishment that is blind to what most Americans experience day to day?
No. I think
you do not.
I don't. And listen, I don't dispute, you know, some people have been in political consulting and done well and had good careers. You know, that happens. But I think, you know, with Biden and the people around him, you had a very close-knit group of people who were extremely loyal to him.
That's one way of describing it.
Yeah, well, and they, you know, sometimes they just couldn't see the flaws that were right in front of them. And it was a big mistake. I think anybody who could have, you know, been in there and seen it, you know, should have known that this was not good for the president and wasn't good for the country.
Was Bernie screwed in 2020?
Well, I wouldn't, again, you know, I mean, I wasn't there in 2020, first of all. Actually, I worked for Andrew Yang in 2020, okay, if you can believe it. I mean, he came to my office
Andrew,
one day.
He's been a guest on this program
many times. He and I went to the same college, you know, and we wound up doing, I think, some really great work for him. My partners, you know, Julia Mulvey and Mark Longabaugh and I. But, you know, what happened to Bernie in 2020 is what I told him would happen to him in 2016, which is this. I said, listen, the only way for you to win is we got to beat her in Iowa, beat her in New Hampshire, beat her in Nevada, somehow figure out how we're going to win South Carolina, which if we do those three, I think we could. I said, and then we will face the second front from the entire establishment. And that's what happened in 2020. The entire establishment, after Biden lost those three.
Biden comes in.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fourth in Iowa, fifth in New Hampshire.
Sure.
Win South Carolina. Says, that's it. It's over.
Yeah, and lost Nevada too. Then he won South Carolina, and that
but one victory is enough.
Yeah, but that second front, which I told Bernie, I said, listen, say we do that and we beat Hillary Clinton, we're gonna have to take on the whole establishment then, because they're just not gonna, you know, because they'll hear Democratic socialist, okay, and they won't be able to handle it, and we're going to have to just turn to people. We're going to have to make sure they understand that the people are going to make this choice, not the power brokers. Mm-hmm.
So, as you know, you've been through a lot of national campaigns, and the end of them, there's lots of statistics people can call through. I've come across two from 2024. I think they're meaningful. Mm-hmm. I'd like your opinion as to whether or not they are or not. So, if you compare the 2020 Biden vote to the 2024 Harris vote in California, let's start there, my home state where I grew up.
Right.
The difference is a negative 1.9 million votes. Mm-hmm. In New York, it's 900,000 negative. Right. In New Jersey, it's 400,000 negative. In Illinois, it's 400,000 negative. In Texas, it's 400,000 negative. These are all places where the campaign was not joined.
Yes.
It was not actively fought over.
Yep.
And the Democratic vote collapsed by these numbers in all of those states.
Right.
To me, that's meaningful. Is it to you?
It is. It's very meaningful. And it's a lesson that I would hope my party...
Why do you think that happened?
It happened because of a lack of enthusiasm on the part of Democrats to participate in the general election. It happened because people felt that they weren't being represented by the, you know, ticket that was running for the top office in the land. It happened because the party, you know...
Stuffed something down their throat.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's one way of putting it. But, I mean, I guess I would say is, listen, I would put it differently. They didn't listen, okay? You have to listen to voters. The biggest thing the Democrats need to do right now is give power back to voters to nominate someone as the president. And by the way, in my view, it's my personal opinion, that's not what's happening right now. For example, the Democratic National Committee is putting together a nominating process, and they've decided that South Carolina, who got put there at the beginning by Joe Biden because his people didn't want him running in states that he had lost before, you know, is going to be the first. I think that's a big mistake. And by the way, it's nothing against South Carolina. I think it's a great event. But I agree with Jim Clyburn, who said we're better off batting cleanup, the fourth one, than leadoff, the first one. Okay, you know, and I think he's absolutely right.
Who should go first?
Well, I think New Hampshire should be the first primary. Okay, and because I believe the New Hampshire primary is just a it's a gem of an event. I mean, I guess because I've been going there for so long.
I've done them since 92. It's fun.
You know, I mean, these people in New Hampshire take it so seriously. They come to all the Republican events, they come to all the Democratic events, and then they decide who they're going to vote for as we come to the election. They know a lot about the candidates. It's a small enough state where you can get around.
Okay, so New Hampshire first.
New Hampshire, I would put...
Then?
Well, then I think we need someone from the Midwest. I think
Michigan.
I think Michigan to me would be an ideal replacement. Now, and not that I don't love Iowa. I do love Iowa too. But I want to tell you, even, and this happened in 2016, I think it happened in 2020 again. You know, Iowa, they lost control of the process
they
in
did.
Iowa. They were, and you know, unfortunately, I think that they're going to have to pay the price for that. Michigan, I think, can be a tremendous event where, and you know, somehow if the Michigan and New Hampshire can figure it out.
So the Tadbine calendar is New Hampshire, Michigan, yeah, Nevada, South Carolina.
That's right. It is. And if we, and let me tell you, if we got that calendar, if we got it, I think whoever came out of it would win the general election just by virtue of the way the calendar is structured.
I have another meaningful number from 2024, but it also dovetails with 2020 and 2016. This is the Trump Latino vote. Mm. 2016. These are all Pew numbers.
Right.
28% in 2016, mm-hmm. 36% yeah. in 2020, 48%
yeah.
in 2020. What is that about, Tad?
That's about a critically important group in the electorate for Democrats, okay, Latinos, and particularly Latino men who went and, the, and really drove that number, being feeling like they're not being listened to, that they're left out, they're left behind, that no one's talking to them, that someone doesn't, that the party doesn't understand the issues that are of concern to them.
And the party's not strong enough.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, we can take it on in those ways. I think part of it is image, but a lot of it is substance, you know, the policies that they were pursuing. But I think it also is the Republicans successfully got to a lot of those voters and convinced them that the Democrats were out of touch with them. Okay, and I'll give you an example of what happened. The Trump campaign in the last election ran an ad about, you know, Kamala Harris
yep.
supporting, you know, transgender prisoners getting operations
right.
in prison.
Okay,
you
know, expense.
Absolutely. And by the way, they spent $100 million on that one ad. Now, when I worked for John Kerry in 2004, $100 million was the entire budget of the campaign. Okay,
exactly.
including the coordinated expenditures of the Democratic National Committee. We got right. $79 million, and they could do $21 million. It was $100 million. They spent the Harris campaign never answered the spot
right.
on television.
No.
Okay, and you know, I mean,
told themselves it's all okay. We'll be fine.
Well, I think what they told themselves is, what are we going to say? And they never came up with the right thing to say. Or, but as someone who does paid media, okay, when your opponent comes in and they take the thing over with something that is, you know, that people think is authentic, is emotional, and tells a story they can't forget, okay, that's going to be very powerful. Okay, and I think when you know, the Harris campaign decided not to engage in the paid media on that front. You know, and listen, I've seen this, and I've been on the wrong side of these things too. John mm-hmm. Kerry in Swift Boats in 2004. Yeah. You know, we made a big mistake not engaging in the paid media back and forth. And the reason we made that mistake is because we accepted public funding in the general election. And John Kerry got the nomination in July, right. and Bush got the nomination in September, and we had a 13-week campaign, and they had a 7-week campaign, and we both had the same amount of money, okay? And so they attacked us in August when they were spending primary money with Swift Boat. And if we started going into
the media that
yeah,
they got,
then we would have no money for October, okay? And that's why I so strongly advocated within the campaign not to accept public funding, okay? Because I just thought it was unfair, completely unfair, the way the system was structured. But the big point on this is, when you have that kind of paid media engagement, the other side goes after you. You must join them in that medium, and you must make sure that people understand. And I think to an extent, and get back to Mamdani, he had enough money where, sure, he couldn't spend $50 million like the super PACs were, but he could answer the charges in the same medium where he was being attacked.
Right. And he also had a lesser opponent.
Well, yes, he did that. That helps, okay?
Yeah, look, it's always about what are your resources
you
and what
it.
Are you against?
Sure, absolutely. Absolutely.
And what's the overall atmosphere?
Yeah, yeah.
And in 2016, going back to that, everyone knew it was a change election.
Right.
And also, if any Democrat was serious with himself or herself, Hillary Clinton, by no measure, right. except for being a woman,
right.
represented change.
Right. Well, listen, I made that argument to Bernie, you know, after the California primary, as why he needed to go in the other room, call her up and endorse her. I said, listen, it's a change election. She's not a change candidate. And I've done a lot of change elections. Mostly in Latin America, where I learned the word cambio, because if you say it enough in an ad, you're going to win the election, okay, if you're the change candidate, because people desperately want change. And unfortunately, you know, and as someone who's now, I think I've done 29 campaigns outside of the United States and seen a lot of different politics in a lot of different places, I never thought that the politics of my own nation, which so much resemble the politics of Latin America in the early 90s, okay? When I first went there—
They do now.
Yeah, they do. They totally do now. When I first went there, you know, we went to work for Andreas Pastrana in 1994 when he was running for, president of Colombia. You know, I was talking to him. He said, well, listen, Ted, these are our newspapers. These are our television stations. These are our radio stations. And these are, you know, theirs and this is that. And I was like, what are you talking about? Now we have that, okay? This is what we have in the United States of America. And, you know, and I want to tell you, we have to change the system. We got to get rid of the money, and we also have to invigorate the press, which has to be a fully independent body. And right now, unfortunately, corporate ownership and all the pressure, and when you get an administration like the one we have right now with Donald Trump, who will do anything to exert their will on powerful groups, some of whom may want to have, you know, mergers mm-hmm. and acquisitions and all
I've
kinds of things like
that. I've read something about that,
yeah. Yes. Well, that's the problem. We have to free the press. We have to free elections from the influence of special interest money. We have to have rules where people participate and where there's some kind of, we have to get rid of gerrymandering. You know, this sounds like the impossible dream right now, you know, because our politics are so polluted. But I'm telling you, if people want to do it, they can do it. Right now, there is massive support to amend the Constitution to get rid of, say, Citizens United. Republicans, independents, and Democrats, they're all in the 70th and 80th percentile. That's the hard part, convincing people.
And to your point on that, Tad, when you see those numbers, you know that you don't have to do what you have to do in almost every other campaign finance conversation, which is explain to them what this is about.
That's right.
They already know what it's about.
They do.
They figured it out.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why we have to do it. And what does that mean? We have to do it. We have to win elections with this message. That's what we have to do. Mm-hmm. That's what Sanders' 2016 campaign was about. His explanation to people, the very first ad we did, well, we did, when we started advertising, the first ad was right. A biography that began at the Statue of Liberty, because I knew they would call him a socialist. The America ad has 16 scenes in 60 seconds with American flags in it, because I knew they would call him a socialist. But the first 30-second ad
The most did, popular and valuable ad of your campaign,
yeah,
the America
yeah,
ad, the Paul Simon
And ad. It was connecting with people. But the first 30-second ad we did after the bio was Bernie to camera, and he said, it's called a rigged economy, and this is how it works, okay? And he explained in 30 seconds to people what was happening. And we built on that throughout the campaign, and people got it. They know what the problem is. But here's what you have to do. You have to win elections
yes,
with that message, okay? And when that happens, trust me, the politicians will change their views very quickly, okay? So.
As Trump has taught Republicans.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean... He has a very simplified but brutal understanding of politics. Winning is everything.
Right.
And if you win, people will bend to the fact that you can win.
Yeah. And he's been successful, you know, 2 out of 3 times pursuing that. But what the Democrats have to do is they have to understand that they can win and tell the truth. You don't have to lie. They can win and they can deal with real issues that seem like they can't be solved, because there are solutions to these issues. We can fix Social Security. We can provide health care for everyone in this nation. There is plenty of wealth in America to take care of the people of this nation. We just have to have a political system that allows that to happen.
Before I let you go, because you've lived this through all the cycles, the midterm's going to come, there'll be results, and immediately people will begin to plan for 2028 mm-hmm. and vie for the presidential nomination of the Democratic Party. Walk my audience through what that looks like to you. What to watch for? What are you looking for?
Well, I'm looking for someone who, you know, hones...
First of all, do you expect Democrats to take control of the House?
I do.
Do you expect them to take control of the Senate?
I think that's a real possibility, yes.
Okay.
I do.
So
I
if
think
that
this
happens,
is a watershed
let's just,
election.
I'm not saying that's going to happen.
Yeah.
You're projecting that it might. Let's
yes.
just say, for the sake of argument, it does.
Yes.
So it's a great night for Democrats.
Right.
They're ecstatic.
Mm-hmm.
Then what happens?
Well, then the Democrats are going to have to demonstrate to the nation that they can govern. Okay, that's what they're going to have to do. They're going to have to build confidence. Because listen, the Democratic Party is at its lowest point right now, okay? And you know, and people are fleeing both parties and becoming independents in terms of their registration.
So how can they govern if Trump's going to veto everything?
Well, they're going to have to.
You have to pick fights.
You better believe it. They're going to have to pick fights, and they're going to have to make sure that people understand that in the fights that lie ahead, they are on their side.
Is impeachment the fight that they should pick?
Well, I don't think we started impeachment, okay? But I do think the president should be impeached for what he's already done. I mean, this is the most corrupt administration in the history of the United States. I mean, the corruption is almost unbelievable that's occurring right now. Not to mention a reckless war in Iran that we should never have started. And you know, and the list goes on. And to take over the Justice Department and turn it into a private law firm that represents him, you know, that should be grounds for that's a high crime. In my book.
Okay, so that's what the Democrats have to do if they're in the majority of the House and the Senate. What are you going to look for those who are going to vie for the 2028 nomination?
Yeah. Can I say one more thing about the Democrats need to do, because I just thought of this. I'm reminded of George Mitchell and what he did leading up to the election of Bill Clinton. The Democrats went in, they passed, you know, child care. They passed family and medical leave. And they force Bush to veto it every time.
Right.
And that's what they need to do to Trump. Pass the laws that will affect people's life, force them to veto it, and people will understand that we need to get rid of the Republican in the White House, too.
Understood. All right. But for those who are going to look for the nomination in 2028, what are you looking for? I guess the first big call is, does AOC run or not?
Well, yeah, I don't know if she's going to run, but
because that seems to be the question, the progressive lane.
Yeah, I mean, you know, listen, I don't know her. I very much admire her, and I write about her and the mayor and the book, you know, and say that I think they're really important, you know, leaders in the party. I think if you want to be president and you're in your mid-30s, you know, and you've never held an office more than a single congressional district,
it's a high bar,
and you're a woman. Okay, there's a lot of stuff that's going to be going on there. I think she'd be very smart to demonstrate that she could be elected governor or senator of a very big state, you know, which I think if she ran, she would be. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think then, and then if I were her, I wouldn't wait, just like Obama, okay? I'd get in and I'd move as fast as possible. That's just political advice. Now, people are going to run, and some people, you know, Ro Khanna is a good example. Right. You know, he's a congressman, you know, but, you know, does he have to do that in California? Well, you know, maybe it might be easier for him. You know, somehow I have a feeling. But, you know, there are people who are going to rise in the system. They are the people who will come to early states, and really in this state, it's not just about early states anymore. We used to just think, well, I got to go to New Hampshire, Jimmy Carter, I'm going to stay at somebody's house for a few weeks and go move around. You know, that world is gone. But the world of being in front of people is alive 24 hours a day right now.
Yeah.
You have to figure out how you can get your message out to people. And most of all, the most important thing is, what is my message? What is the message I want to deliver to people? Can you do something that is authentic and be authentic yourself? Can you deliver a message that has emotion and touches people's hearts?
And has staying power.
Yeah. And can you tell a story that they remember? Okay. Those are the elements, I think, of successful communication in a political campaign. And if you have someone who has that story, who makes that connection, and it really is all about connection, who is going to connect mm-hmm. with voters? If we find that candidate, I think that candidate's going to win.
How will you be involved, if at all?
Well, I don't know right now. I'm doing three campaigns in my home state of Rhode Island right now: the governor's race, the House race, and the attorney general's race. Okay, so I'm staying home and I'm keeping busy right now. So,
Tad Devine, pleasure.
Major, great to see you.
Thank you.